Hi, this is Amy.
And this is Andrew, and in this episode, AADL talks to David Fenton.
While he was in town for the event surrounding the 40th anniversary of the John Sinclair Freedom Rally, we had the opportunity to talk with David Fenton, founder and CEO of Fenton Communications, about his years in Ann Arbor and their impact on his life and work. David recalls his start in photojournalism, life in the Hill Street Commune, working on the Ann Arbor Sun, and some of the public relations tricks he learned from John Sinclair and Abby Hoffman. He also touches on the darker aspects of the 1960s countercultural excesses and the movement's legacy 40 years on.
I was working at an organization called Liberation News Service, which was the sort of AP, UPI, Reuters of the anti-war underground newspapers around the country. And the local paper was called the Ann Arbor Argus. And in that community, Sinclair's case was a cause célèbre, and everybody knew about it. And, you know, we had had contact with the White Panther Party. I was on my way. I had decided to leave New York, and I was on my way to California, I thought, to set up and be a photographer and an organizer there. And I stopped off to visit the people in the Hill Street House because I had met some of them in New York a couple of times. And I liked it a lot, and I got very taken up with it. And I never left, basically, from 19. I moved in the early 1971, and then we moved the whole thing to Detroit briefly in around late 75 or early 76. And in the summer of 76, I went back to New York.
What was it that you found so appealing that you couldn't continue on your journey?
Well, it was a combination of political, cultural, and personal, isn't everything? I liked the people a lot. I thought that the notion that you could use music and culture to help achieve political change and to rally the population and a generation, which at that time had a lot of commonality of views and viewpoints, I thought that made a lot of political sense. Personally, the aesthetic, the music, the lifestyle, the freedom of it, the personal exploration, the utopianism of it was very appealing. It was very positive. Soon after I arrived, I started learning a bunch of new skills. I mean, I was just a photographer. And all of a sudden, you know, I'm like running the Free John Sinclair campaign and publishing a newspaper and doing a radio show. And I'm, you know, doing press conferences for a third political party and taking over the city government. And, you know, who could leave?
How did you get started in journalism? How did you decide to go into papers and particularly alternative papers?
I was a student in New York in the late 60s at the Bronx High School of Science, and we had a non-official underground newspaper at the school called Sans Culottes, which if you know your French Revolution history. And I started publishing photos in there, and through spending time with the people who had started that newspaper, which we were constantly being suspended from the school and banned, you know, the school didn't want its own newspaper, and then we were terrible troublemakers. We started demanding an African American studies program at the high school, and when our demands were not met, we sat in the principal's office and refused to leave, and the police had to come and clear us out. And my favorite story, actually, from that period, which I tell my children, is we had a dress code at the high school. You were not allowed to wear blue jeans. So one day, the entire student body, all 3,000 kids, showed up wearing blue jeans. That was the end of the dress code.
Yay.
So anyway, through that newspaper, I started meeting people from Liberation News Service and an anti-war film cooperative called Newsreel, and the sort of community of countercultural anti-war journalists. And working with some of those people who ran a newspaper in New York called the New York Free Press, we started the New York High School Underground Free Press. The first issue was a photo I took of a naked black baby holding a black anarchist flag. I have these, by the way. My photographs started getting noticed and published by some of these newspapers, and then by Liberation News Service and by underground papers around the country. And eventually that existence became far more interesting and fulfilling for me than going to school. So I stopped going to school at the beginning of 11th grade, and that was the end of my formal education. I never finished high school, and I never went to college.
I read in an interview that you said you were permanently damaged by the events of the late 1960s and you cannot recover.
Right.
Can you elaborate?
Sure. Well, that's kind of the ghetto use of the word bad. Most of the damage was good. You know, and this is part of what was the positive side of the Hill Street experience. I'm never comfortable calling it the White Panther Party. I got there as that was ending. And I always thought that the notion that there was some equivalence between, hippies and, people being killed by the police in the black community was a little off. Right? But, at the same time, I can understand it because, the police were brutal. And in some places, they still are. Large segments of a whole generation broke with almost all tradition, almost instantaneously. I mean, when else does this happen? You're no longer a Christian. You're no longer a Jew. You're a Buddhist. Your rituals. Your holidays. I mean, all that's out the window like that. And so the sense of an ability to forge a new identity, a new social system, a new community, to do really deep personal exploration, to throw off all kinds of antiquated values and Puritanism, mindless accepting of conventional wisdom and authority. That was very heady stuff. And a lot of it was very positive. And you can see some of this happening now with these Occupy Wall Street kids who are going through something similar. And I think, societies need that kind of refreshing. In fact, I think we need it a lot right now. That was what was that was part of what I meant by permanently damaged. I really can't see the world the way I used to ever again. In the work that my company does, which is all values-based and all progressive, that's a direct outgrowth of what happened to me then. In other words, I personally could not do what so many people in the public relations field do and just take any client as long as they were paying me, no matter whether they were ethical or honest or telling the truth or doing something valuable for society or polluting the environment or ripping off workers. I just couldn't do it. And it's not because, I'm better than somebody else, but this value system and sense of morality an ethical system really got instilled in me back then by that community of alternative journalists and activists. And, I'm very fortunate. I've never had to abandon it, but it came from them. It really came from them.
You also mentioned, and maybe this starts going into the dark side a little bit, but that there was a lot of craziness and delusion among some of the countercultural leaders. And how did that negatively affect the movement at the time?
Well, I think it negatively affected the whole country, and I think it's still negatively affecting it. There were crazy excesses of rhetoric. I knew Abbie Hoffman very well, and I considered him a very dear friend, and I think he's a truly great and important historical figure. But he was crazy as a loon. And he was clinically crazy. He was deeply bipolar, and he eventually committed suicide. It was very tragic. I mean, Abbie would walk around at demonstrations chanting, "Off the pig." Now, this, is not exactly going to endear this movement to the, average American, and nor should it. Just because some police are brutal doesn't mean you talk about killing them, even metaphorically. I mean, that is nuts. And, okay, you could sort of understand it. I used to see people carrying signs saying that in Harlem and in Spanish Harlem and in, Oakland at the height of the police repression. So, that was a sort of authentic response, even though I think it was very misguided. But, you know, Abby came out here to Ann Arbor once. I don't think I was there, but I know this happened. And at one of the press conferences he had to demand that Sinclair be released from prison, he took a knife out of his pocket and put it on the table and said, you know, we're going to get these people. So the, you know, the over-in-your-face rhetoric, I think, and some, this is tougher because some of the cultural experimentation was very good, you know, and thank goodness it happened or you wouldn't. You know, the amount of change that's happened in the status of women and of gays, you know, in the sexual revolution and the throwing off of all this mindless Puritanism that was, you know, very ensconced, especially here in the Midwest. I mean, that was all great, but the excesses of it, I mean, this is part of what fueled Nixon, Reagan, Newt Gingrich, you know, the whole Republican counter-reaction. We overdid it, let's face it. And then you take a look at another group that I had contact with at that time, the people that became the Weather Underground. Now, they were really delusional. I mean, they thought that they were going to carry out an armed revolution in the United States of America. That's insane. And they really believed it. I was living with a woman in New York just before I moved out here. And she was a Barnard graduate, very educated, you know, upper middle class family, and she was spending time with Bernardine Dorn and Bill Ayers. And one day she came home after being gone all day, and her clothes were tattered, and she was bruised. And I said to her, "What happened?" And she said, "Oh, it was the greatest day of my life." I said, "What?" She said, "Oh, yeah, we went to a high school in Pittsburgh and liberated the students and fought with the police." This is the kind of craziness that was happening. And another aspect of this that I think is poorly understood historically is that there was a real negative impact of psychedelic drugs on some of this. You know, you'd have to talk to the psychologist, but you know, psychedelic drugs can be beneficial if properly used, you know, under good supervision in the right circumstances, you know, in nature with the right people. I believe that the country should authorize more therapeutic use of these substances. At the same time, like anything else, they can have a really dark and horrible side, and they can induce psychosis, and they did. And you know, one of the hallmarks of psychosis, of course, is grandiosity. We're going to make a revolution and have an armed rebellion. And paranoia. You know, these people definitely were affected by this. And that happened here, too. I think there's no question about it. But again, it's a really complex situation because at the same time, much of what came out of that period that's good, the human potential movement, the growth of the environmental movement, the movement towards greater physical fitness, towards cleaner and healthier food, towards medical self-care, you know, all the way to Gary Grimshaw's art and changes in the whole aesthetic. That was the positive side of what some of the drug experimentation did. But there was a dark side, and that's why, you know, in my opinion, these substances being totally illegal is completely crazy because there's no assist. Kids are going to take them. They take them. So to have it outside of medical and mental health framework is just really counterproductive.
Had the Hill Street community, you said that the White Panther period had sort of ended. Had they ended their rhetoric? Because there was a time when they were taking pictures of, you know, the MC5 and the Up with guns, and Pun Plamondon was out shouting all kinds of things.
Yeah, by the time I moved here, thank God that had ended.
Okay, so you didn't have to play a role in trying to help them tone it down.
I mean, John was in jail. You know, the first time I met Pun Plamondon, it was in federal penitentiary in Indiana. There were no guns around. And I would not have been comfortable with that. Now, I had been – my memory of this is a little murky. There was a thing we used to have conferences every now and then where people that ran all the underground newspapers around the country would gather. I'm sure the first one I went to was in Madison, Wisconsin, probably late 1968. And then there was one here in Ann Arbor in an area just outside of town, a rural area. And the reason that's important is we were meeting in Pond, and I think Jeannie Plamondon were guarding the entryway with rifles. You know, this was the height of the White Panther aesthetic. And we're all sitting there having a meeting, and all of a sudden we realize that from every direction, 360 degrees, the police are descending upon us. And there was absolutely no escape. And I remember watching people, you know, start emptying their pockets and throwing things on the ground. And it was very scary. These were armed police emerging from the woods like we were some kind of group of terrorists. You know, we were a bunch of journalists. And a bunch of people were arrested. So, you know, I mean, it was really unfortunate that I think the imagery and rhetoric of the White Panthers, you know, understandably provoked the police and made them paranoid, which came back again the other way. So, no, by the time I got here, that had thankfully all ended. That was gone.
So I'm curious. You have this very successful public relations company. And do you feel that that was the logical next step? And how come more people didn't go that route? Why were many of the leaders, the countercultural leaders, unable to do that, unable to do what you did? And for example, where do you see John Sinclair on that spectrum?
Well, I learned public relations from John. I mean, I did. And I really owe him a huge debt for that. And he's a genius at it. And I also learned it from Abby Hoffman and Jerry Rubin, who, I mean, literally taught me. But the first way I learned it, so I come to Ann Arbor. I'm 18 years old. I'm a high school dropout. You know, all I've ever done is photography. And so Lenny decides that I should start being involved in this effort to get her husband out of jail. So I visit John at Jackson State Prison. We meet for the first time. I guess he sizes me up and, you know, he starts telling me some things that I should start thinking about to do for him. And then I start getting letters from prison. And I wonder if these letters are in the Bentley collection. We should look. So these are handwritten, very long, very detailed letters on yellow legal pads telling me exactly what journalists to call. And, you know, I remember one said, take my wife Lenny to the Michigan Supreme Court and bind her hands behind her back and put a gag in her mouth. This was right after Bobby Seale had been bound and gagged at the Chicago 7 trial. And call the press. You know, I didn't know what I was doing. I was just following instructions. And it worked. So my introduction to talking to journalists, organizing messages, creating imagery, that all came from John. There's no question about it. As to why other people from that era weren't able to go on and do other kinds of enterprises. Well, a lot of people did. The leaders didn't. And, you know, people used to joke that Abby should start an advertising firm. In fact, somebody made a movie once that had a Hollywood movie that had an Abby-like figure who eventually became the head of a Madison Avenue advertising firm. I forget the name of it. And I used to call Abby up when I had trouble. You know, I needed to name something. You know, I had to figure out some message, and he was incredible at it. Like my first book, Photographs, which was called Shots, which is a great name, right? So when I asked Abby what I should call it, he came up with that name. But this was sort of typical. He said, no, call it Shots of War, you know, Mr. Militant. And I thought, you know, Abby, that's a little much. How about just Shots? So I think that, you know, when you become a celebrity, it's really hard not to have your ego go completely berserk. And I've known a lot of celebrities and a lot of politicians and heads of state, and it happens to all of them, movie stars, et cetera. So I think that there must be something about the psychological and ego impact of that kind of experience that makes sort of the step-by-step, you know, nose-to-the-grindstone work of building an enterprise, you know, hey, I'm a celebrity. It should just – but at the same time, you know, a lot of those people wrote great books and made enormous contributions. So I don't really know the answer to that. But below the level of leadership, there are 60s people everywhere running companies and, you know, doing and arts institutions and universities and doing and being great scientists and great artists. And, you know, we're kind of everywhere. Look at Steve Jobs, you know. I mean, Steve Jobs, who, you know, if you read the new Walter Isaacson biography, he was such a hippie, people would throw him out of their offices because he smelled bad. And he thought he didn't smell bad. He ate all fruits and vegetables, so he figured he only needed to bathe once a week and didn't need to use deodorant. And Steve Jobs, you know, a number of times on the record talked about how the aesthetic and self-searching, you know, he went to India to study with his guru. He acknowledged taking LSD, and he said that it had a positive impact on his sense of design. So it's not like that era didn't also lead to you know, great enterprises. Look at Apple; it's the most valuable company in the world.
So when you were starting out doing this kind of PR work, because everyone, including you, was either self-taught or learning from someone who was self-taught, because nobody taught John Sinclair how to get the word out about things, were you guys making up new methods of getting the word out about things as you went along? Were you making up new PR strategies that no one had really used before?
Yeah. Yeah. You know, I kind of look at it like this. Abby Hoffman and Roger Ailes. Roger Ailes runs Fox News now. And he ran Nixon's reelection campaign. And the book, The Making of the President, 1972, chronicles what he did. So, you know, I think in post-war American history, the two people who understood the most the influence and the impact that television was going to have on politics were Abby and Roger Ailes. So they made it all up. How could you teach it? Television was new. You know, how could you teach electric guitar when it first came out? You couldn't. You had to figure it out. And, of course, the other thing is – and the way that they were similar is they both understood – the use of television to project mythologies. And I would say Abby was better at it than Ailes because, you know, Ailes had the machinery of state at his disposal and the Republican Party, quite a lot of resources. Abby had nothing. And yet Abby started this thing that he called the Youth International Party, right, the Yippies, which Jerry later desecrated by making it materialistic and becoming the Yuppies. So who was the Youth International Party? You'd open the New York Times, you know, a spokesman for the Youth International Party today. And, you know, the Walter Cronkite News, the Youth International Party is doing this. It was like Abby and three people. It was a totally made up myth that had a gigantic impact, on politics and culture. So, sure, you couldn't teach that. And, you know, the other thing is that my staff won't let me use the word public relations. It's such a pejorative word. You know, what it really means in our culture is, you know, we'll say anything for money. So we don't want to think we do that. But, you know, communications, sure, you can teach aspects of it. But ultimately, it's like sales. It's persuasion. It's being articulate. You know, it's knowing what a story is. You don't really have to go to school to do it. Most of the people that we hire have never studied it.
You had said that MoveOn.org is the modern inheritor of the underground press. And I wonder if you could talk about what you learned with working on the Ann Arbor and the Detroit Sun and how that translates into modern media.
Well, I didn't work on the Detroit Sun.
You didn't. Okay.
Oh, actually, wait a minute. We renamed it that. I forgot. Because there was a Detroit Sun prior to the Ann Arbor
Sun. The Warren Forest Sun.
Translove Energies and all that. Right. Yeah. And that's interesting. You know, I thought moving the Sun to Detroit was a giant mistake. And let's hold on to that question for a minute, but I'd like to pursue this. The part of why Sinclair left Ann Arbor and moved everything to Detroit was because he was being rejected here. And, you know, before he went to jail and when he first got out of prison, you know, the whole operation was very popular. And through the Human Rights Party victory, which was April or May of 1972, very popular. By a year later than that, not popular, plummeting. Two reasons, I think. One is that the people that got elected to the swing seats on the city council, Nancy Wexler and...
Jerry DeGree.
There you go. So they turned out to be very sectarian. They were members of some, I think, Trotskyite weird group called the International Socialists. And I knew we were in trouble when one day I saw Nancy give a speech where she said that what should happen in Vietnam is that the Viet Cong should win. And, you know, I agreed with that, but because it was their country. But politically, that was a very stupid thing to emphasize and completely irrelevant to anything that was going to happen in Ann Arbor anyway. So meanwhile, on the Sinclair front, we started alienating people too. You know, there was a certain arrogance, and this was linked to this kind of comical attempt to have a Marxist-Leninist organizing structure. The Central Committee is issuing communiques, right? and page after page of the Sun started being devoted, you know, to the self-criticism and reexamination of the Central Committee, and people were going, what? And then I think there was another element which, you know, I can't precisely verify, but I'm sure that there were police provocateurs operating here. You know, the thing about the rhetoric of the White Panthers and then the Lenin thing and, you know, the Nixon move to deport him, it was potentially very powerful. So, A lot of very disparaging false information started being hurled at us, including from a newspaper in this town that I think was called New Morning. And it was run by a guy, you'll have to ask other people, George something. And we were always very suspicious of this operation. And, you know, we've all looked at our Ann Arbor police and FBI files, and all the identities of all the agents are redacted. That's the right word, right? Yeah, they're all crossed out. So there clearly were quite a few of them. So I think that there's no question that there were COINTELPRO type, you know, the FBI counterinsurgency stuff happening here. But you can't just blame it on that. We were arrogant. We knew better. You know, we told people what kind of music they should like, how they should think. And, you know, as John got to be more of a celebrity, got more and more cut off. So I think that was eventually, John was not very well liked here. So his solution to that was to move to Detroit and to embrace the movement of, local African-American self-determination in Detroit is what he was going to go back to. And, of course, his roots were, as, you know, the in the beatnik era of being very close to especially the artists and poets in the black community. So he was kind of going back to his roots. Now, I thought that that wasn't our community and that the notion that a bunch of white kids were going to go to Detroit and publish a newspaper for the black community was crazy. And, of course, it was. And it was a giant failure. Had the paper gone to Detroit and focused on white kids in the suburbs who we knew how to appeal to and who also had money to spend and where there were advertisers, then it might have worked. So I think it was driven largely by emotional reasons, not real strategic calculations. And it was a giant mistake, and it went bust. I think the Sun would still be here today, possibly, if it wasn't for that. Did I answer your question?
I just meant I had asked about the MoveOn.org in the new media, what you
– Okay. So MoveOn's not really a media. You know, it's an organization for democratic action, and it's not very cultural. A lot of its demographic is older, so there are 60s type people in there. It's 5 million people. It's quite significant. I mean, certainly the ability to reach people directly without going through corporate media, is a very good thing and reflects some of that kind of change. I actually don't think right now that there is an effective equivalent to the underground press online. You know, there's a lot of very scattered stuff you can find, and some of it's terrific, but it takes a lot of work to find it. And the Huffington Post fulfills some of this, but it's also a place for celebrity watching, and it doesn't have a lot of deep narrative journalism. It has excellent blogs, so I don't think it's come along yet. Really, I think it will, and I think the Occupy movement, if it grows, which I'm quite sure it will eventually lead us to this. And some MoveOn people are talking about setting up more of a system to get people easy access to alternative information and videos. But it's still in ferment. I think it's not there yet.
The picture you just painted a second ago about the Ann Arbor Sun moving to Detroit made it sound as though John Sinclair was very much still in charge of the organization and the newspaper and what was published in the paper. Was it not... Even though there was a central committee, was that central committee not quite as democratic as it could have been? If John decided something, is that
well? This
much
all
what
went
happened?
Through different phases. You know, by the later years of the Sun here, I think 75 certainly, there was no more central committee. There was no more commune. We all got to have our own personal property. That was a big change. I went 3 years where I had to ask permission to buy a pair of blue jeans. We didn't have any money, Sinclair still ran the show, basically, yes. And when something came along that he didn't like, that was important, he would overturn it. Yeah. You know, there was a lot of great things about this. People had huge opportunities to transform themselves and to grow and change and examine themselves, and it was beautiful. But there were cult-like aspects to it. You know, there was intimidation, there was abuse, there was emotional abuse. You know, people were hurt. There was some brainwashing, there was some mind control, there were power struggles. These are human beings. We all have a dark side, it was not all fun and beds of roses. And John, is again, I've learned so much from him, and I wouldn't be who I am today without his influence. And by the way, one of his greatest influences, I think, was his knowledge and propagation of the most amazing music that this country's ever produced. My 15-year-old son is named Cole after John Coltrane. My 11-year-old son is named Theo after Thelonious Monk. I wouldn't have known hardly any of that without John, and that's a deeply important thing. You know, and I wish the country had more access and exposure to that music. I think, you know, it's a tragedy that kids in America today never hear Duke Ellington. I mean, what? I mean, it's the greatest thing America's ever produced. So, you know, that was all great. But, you know, he's an extremely narcissistic person. And he was abusive.
Have you ever gone back to look at The Sun or look at any of the other work that you produced or just thought back to the time and thought about how quickly and significantly you grew as people and as an organization? I mean, you can look at the beginning of The Sun, and just a few years later, you have moved to putting out a very professional, viable newspaper. And 4 years before that, no one would have looked at the mimeographed things that were coming out and thought that was in any way possible.
Then they shouldn't have looked at it. I remember the first article I wrote for The Sun, I had never written an article before. I flew to Washington for Rennie Davis's shut down the government demonstration. That must have been May of 1971. It was May Day. And came back and, you know, wrote this thing, and there was no editor. I just put it in the paper. I didn't know how to write. I mean, that stuff was juvenile. It's amazing it survived. Yeah, I've looked at it. You know, I think one of the greatest things about The Sun is over time it became a really brilliantly designed newspaper. And I'm biased. I married the art director, Barbara Weinberg, who's here. You should talk to
her. We plan to.
You should talk to her. I wonder if she, if she would. She had particular experiences with John that you might find interesting. And when you look back on it, you know, the whole natural foods emphasis that the country's adopted, we were early in there. You know, the whole alternative energy, anti-nuclear power, anti-fossil fuel effort. Of course, the hole in the ozone work was done here at the University of Michigan, so we were the first to publish that. You know, the music and cultural coverage, I think, was phenomenal and really ahead of its time. And we launched quite a few careers, you know. There's a guy here, Michael Castleman, who was our health writer. And one day we realized that circulation was flagging, and we figured, you know, we need to come up with some really strong cover idea to boost sales. And we figured, well, better use sex. It's tried and true. So we went to Michael and said, you need to write a cover story about sex. We had no idea about what. And he said, I'll never do that. Are you kidding? How embarrassing. So he did, and it was a big selling issue, and he started writing regular sex advice columns, and then later he became the Playboy advisor. And he's written a bunch of health and sex books and, you know, became like the leading – I think he runs a sex site now called Great Sex Over 40. You know, Kathy Kelly, who worked with Barbara on the design of the newspaper, I saw her last night for the first time since Badan. And she's had a long career as a graphic designer in publishing. Bill Adler, who was our music critic, later went on to be the chief of all the marketing and public relations for Def Jam Records, and basically played a seminal role in the crossover of rap music to the white mainstream audience. So, you know, people made some good use of all this. They did.
So at what point did you break with Sinclair and with that whole group and move on to other things? Was it immediately to Rolling Stone? Is that what you moved on to immediately?
Yeah. I went back to New York, very disillusioned. And it was a combination of personal and political. Yeah, what happened is we had a certain amount of funding available for the newspaper. And at a certain point, it was going to run out. And when John pushed us to move to Detroit, we started spending a lot of money. And, you know, the funding was disappearing very quickly. And so I reached the conclusion that we should shut the paper rather than use up all the money, because it came from someone who had inherited money, and I thought it'd be quite unfair to use it all up. And this meant that John was going to lose his source of income. So, and I'm not saying that that would be the only reason he would do this. I mean, he was committed to the course he was on. And I'm sure, you know, in his mind, he thought he was doing the right thing. So, you know, I recommended closing it. You know, he put a great deal of pressure on the people who had inherited the money to keep it going. And so I just left, because I could just see it was headed to disaster. And it, you know, it lasted, I don't know, another 6 or 9 months, and they spent a fortune, you know, and it all really just went completely down the tubes and really hurt the lives of some people. So I went back to New York and very disillusioned and, you know, really questioning my own role in, I mean, what are the hallmarks of a cult? You have a all-knowing guru. You know, you're unquestioning. You know, there's no criticism. You have a sense of grandiosity of your mission together. I realized that for all the good things that came out of the experience, you know, this was my substitute family, and I had had a very wrecked family as a kid. My mother was very mentally ill and in institutions a lot, and my father was quite absent. So, you know, as much as anything else, the reason I stayed here was I moved into a commune. I had a family. And so it's, I think, you know, healthy to eventually reach the point where you don't need that anymore and you see through the mythology. But again, you know, John and I are friends. I've seen him. We've spent time together. You know, all in all, that was a very positive experience, and I'm glad I knew him. You know, the Marxist-Leninist organization thing was kind of funny when you think about it. You know, hair down to our waist, you know, getting high, you know, playing all this loud music. And we were having central committees and criticism, self-criticism meetings. Now, they were brutal. You know, 30 people sitting around this massive table about this long. And we'd go around and tell each other what we didn't like about each other. Sounds horrible, right? And it was. But, you know, it was also good. We learned to appreciate hearing other people's perspectives about ourselves. And we developed, many of us, a greater openness to that than comes naturally to people in our culture. You know, I learned to really try hard to understand other people's perspectives about me. And it changed me a lot. It was great, but it was brutal. It was hard. It was awful. And when you read about how the Chinese used this in the Maoist era and the period after before the Cultural Revolution went completely nuts, which it did, but there was a period before then where, you know, peasants would sit down with landlords and tell them what it felt like to be oppressed by them. And people, you know, some of it was good. So we had all that. So at that time in our commune and in some others around the country, in line with the emergence of the women's movement, but not exactly, there was a lot of questioning of monogamy. You know, a lot of the women in these relationships were really dominated, and, you know, that was one aspect of it. The other aspect of it was just plain old lust. You know, people, it was a very sexually active time. There was no HIV. You didn't need to use condoms. Everybody was on the pill. And so, and we were questioning all social norms and all social mores. And, you know, there was a lot of experimentation. So, in a number of these criticism, self-criticism group meetings, we started discussing whether monogamy should be allowed. And eventually, we decided one day that it shouldn't be. Kind of Stalinist, right? So we actually decreed. This was not like top down. the whole group decided we were going to end it that day. And that night, all the couples slept with other people. Now, this must have lasted 1 or 2 days. And, you know, it was really hurtful to people. It was awful. It was crazy. And luckily, we recovered from it and kind of went back to normal. You know, or another aspect of our craziness. So on the one hand, we had this very good thing, which is we had this chart system where everybody was assigned to do chores. And everybody had to work for the benefit of the organization. And like I said, nobody had any private property. None. Not a book. Nothing. You know, that was a bourgeois something or other. So people were assigned to cook or to watch the front door or to do cleanup duties or, you know, to help staff the community organizations in Ann Arbor, you know, like the drug crisis hotline and the free clinic. And so, but one of the things that was put on a chart system was taking care of the children. There were three kids, Una Bach, I think you have a photo of her in the, and Celia and Marion Sunny Sinclair. So each day, a different person would take care of those kids and spend time with them and play with them and feed them and put them to bed. And they saw their parents, but not so much. Was that good? I don't think so. So I get to Ann Arbor. I'm 18 years old. I'd never taken care of a child. All of a sudden, one night a week, from I think it was right after dinner until the next morning, I was in charge of three kids by myself. You know, I think the parents would feed them, and then, you know, I'd have to play with them and clean them and put them to bed. And, you know, this was my duty to the cause. Was that good for those children? I mean, I did the best I could, but I don't think that was too smart. So there were a lot of crazy excesses in that. And what do you expect? You know, we didn't think we were bound by any tradition whatsoever. So it was an unusual time. You know, here's another document I wonder if is in the Bentley Library. You know, the when Punt's case for allegedly blowing up the CIA office in Ann Arbor. And this was before I got here, and I have no idea if he did it. And I'm going to ask him today.
Good.
The CIA wasn't allowed to have an office here. It was totally illegal. The charter of the CIA forbade them specifically from having any offices anywhere but Langley, Virginia. Oh, yeah. That's a fact. So the case was thrown out when it turned out they were wiretapping the Hill Street phone without a warrant. And when this was revealed in court, the judge threw it out, illegal wiretapping. So my understanding, and Buck Davis, the lawyer, is here, is they had transcribed hours and hours and days and days and days of everything that happened on that phone. And Buck got the transcripts. Where are they?
We talked to him about that.
Oh, yeah?
We've interviewed him.
Yeah.
And he's got them, but
is there some kind of an injunction or something?
There's some reason he can't release them. We also interviewed Judge Damon Keith.
Judge Keith.
And
yeah,
it's on there. And he said, there's a funny moment. He says, I looked at those and there's nothing on there.
I would think it's mostly like drug deals,
yeah,
you know, not much.
Yes, right.
You know, people talking to their love partners.
But yeah.
Well, I wish he could release them. I'd love to look at it.
Yeah.
We asked.
Yeah.
You know, this is very yin-yang also, like everything. So on the negative side, the over-celebration of drugs was terrible. I mean, I know people who died. You know, the guy that was the ad salesman for The Sun, Tom Pamaski, a lovely guy, I think was from Ypsilanti, he would drive stoned all the time and was killed in a car crash. You know, I saw people have epileptic seizures. I saw people, you know, lose all motivation. I saw people, you know, have psychotic episodes, bad ones. And a lot of damage. You know, I saw people who, you know, would take LSD and have a really bad experience, but because the mythology of the organization and the writings and the culture of music at the time and Tim Leary and all that, you know, they said, well, I'm just going to keep doing it until I have this mystical, wonderful, transcendent experience. And some of them got really hurt. Really hurt. I mean, let's face it. If people get up in the morning and smoke pot and smoke it again at lunchtime, smoke it again in the afternoon, smoke it again at night, and do that every day for years and years and years, something is a matter. You know, sure, it's not physiologically addicting. And, you know, federal law still classifies marijuana as in the same schedule as morphine. I mean, that's just insane. But the all the celebration of pot as a sacrament and all this is, you know, is part of spiritual practice was never accompanied ever by any warnings of abuse or overuse or what to look out for or, you know, what would constitute behavior that would be excessive. It'd be like promoting alcohol as, you know, just only a great thing no matter how much you took. That's what we did. And that was John. And that was, you know, not helpful and hurt a lot of people. You know, I talked before about the positive side of psychedelic experimentation, which I really do believe. And, you know, occasional recreational use of marijuana is more benign than drinking beer. It is. All the medical and scientific evidence is clear about that, not to mention that, you know, beer can help cancer patients reduce pain or increase their appetite. But it was overly promoted and unquestionably overpromoted. And I think that that is a dark legacy of this thing that I've never heard anybody else talk about.
A lot of the people we talk to have almost nothing but positive things to say about the entire experience of being in the commune. And
right.
It's all very positive.
Right.
How do you account for that, the sort of different, you know?
Maybe they've done less psychoanalysis than I have. I think it's a human tendency, right, to just celebrate the positive. It's also a very Midwestern tendency, isn't it? So maybe that's the answer. I don't really know. I guess the answer to that is people don't like to relive and face painful experiences. But you can't learn if you don't, and you certainly can't write accurate history if you don't. Here's a public story. So you have to understand the mindset of the time. You know, kids were smoking marijuana everywhere. The hash bash on the Diag at the University of Michigan, you know. What was one of the very first things we did when we got the swing votes on the Ann Arbor City Council? We made the sale and possession of marijuana a $5 parking ticket. I've heard it's $10 now. Is that true?
Or is it a little more?
I think it's
25.
See? Okay, that was us. The first thing we did. And understandably, because you lived in fear of your life being ruined and disrupted by, you know, this madness, this Puritan crazy madness. And, I mean, it's hard to imagine how bad it was. And it was bad here. This guy, Sheriff Harvey, he was terrible. But if you lived in places like Mississippi and Texas and Alabama, you know, your life was ruined. And the police, you know, if they found somebody in a car with, you know, one joint, goodbye. Your life is over. So you could understand why we thought we should get rid of this. And we did. So with that as the mindset of the time, unfortunately, you know, the police were viewed as the enemy. And I think that's really a shame. And that's why I really think these drug laws need to be fixed, because I actually think respect for the law is an important thing. So we should have laws that people can respect. So we decided that as a public service, the Sun was going to start publishing photographs of undercover narcotics agents who were busting people solely for marijuana. I mean, heroin dealing, that's a whole other thing. And As you might imagine, the police were not happy about this. And we would stake out the courthouse, and when the undercover agents would testify at trials, we would take their photograph and we'd put them in the paper saying, you know, I forget what we called it, watch a narc or something. So, and one of the photographers who did this was a very petite blonde woman. She must have been 20 years old. And one day, as she was standing outside the courthouse, she started photographing this very broad-chested, big football player cop. And he saw her taking his picture, and he knew what this was. And he rushed her and knocked her to the ground violently and, you know, tried to take her camera, which she did not get. And so we sued him for assault. And you should look this up because I probably don't have the exact details of this exactly right. But I know that what happened is after we sued him for assault, he countersued us. Intentional infliction of emotional harm. That by publishing his photograph, we were exposing him to emotional harm and perhaps real harm. So I called the ACLU national office in New York and said, help, because this was going to put the son out of business. And it was a very complicated issue because on the one hand, it's a free press. If you can't publish the photos of the police, how's it a free press? And it was also, from our perspective, a genuine public service because these people were really hurting innocent people who were smoking a joint, you know, in between going to a bar at night or something. I mean, who cares? And understandably, from the police's perspective, this was pressure on them and, you know, causing them stress and grief. So this was a very delicate thing. So the ACLU got involved and took the case, and the jury found for the policeman against us at the local court level. You know, huge judgment, like goodbye, we're out. And this went all the way to the U.S. Supreme Court, and they protected our right to publish the photographs. That's a really important case that very few people know about.
We didn't know about that. We're going to be digging things out as we go along with this project.
I don't remember who the ACLU lawyer was, but that was an important case.
Yeah.
And a tough one.
Yeah.
How would you decide? That's a tough case. But for us it was, you know, these people were, you know, hurting students, you know, hurting all these people. So did you see the other unique promotion the son engaged in?
The Pound of Columbia.
The contest.
Yeah, that was pretty unique. 2 years in a row. And did you see where we held the drawing for the winner?
Wasn't it in the city?
In front of the police station.
Yeah.
And did you see who picked the winner?
The
Democratic County Commissioner. So you could see from our perspective back then, I mean, that was majoritarian rule. And I'll never forget, it was very funny. When we decided to do that contest, we talked to the lawyers. You know, well, what is our risk here, blah, blah, blah. And they said, well, you know, you have to be very careful. You can't require people to buy the Sun in order to enter the contest because, you know, no purchase necessary. That's the law. And we said, this whole thing is so illegal, we're just not going to listen to that. And we required people to buy the Sun to get the entry coupon. And we got a lot of entries, sold a lot of papers. And, of course, a lot of people thought that, you know, this was all a spoof, that, you know, who would be crazy enough to risk actually delivering the prize to somebody. But we were very committed to truth and journalism.
Oh, my God.
You know, as we get closer to complete national decriminalization of marijuana, which I think we're very close to in this country, we're at 60% support. Is now, what, 18 states? I mean, and you know, also, do you know the first attempt to legalize marijuana on a state ballot was in Michigan? It failed miserably, but it was the first. The I think all these efforts will appear very charming and pioneering. And, you know, it's easy to talk about it now. You know, Bill Clinton only thought he could say he'd never inhaled. Nobody believed him. Just look at pictures of what he looked like back then and see if you really believe he didn't inhale. Have you ever seen pictures of Bill Clinton inhale? And then we have a president who says, oh, yeah, I did a little blow. So it's now safe to talk about this stuff. But as I said, there was a downside to the over-celebration of this. And, you know, it's not fair. You have to have warning labels on things. You know, you do.
So I have to ask you, part of the whole aesthetic, the whole movement was forming alternatives to institutions that already existed. So we don't like the way the cops do security. We're going to make the Psychedelic Rangers. We don't like the Ann Arbor News. We're going to do the Ann Arbor Sun. Did that have – how much of an impact did that have on you as someone who 7 years later founded your company, which is a PR firm dedicated to progressive causes,
yeah, totally.
Which was not done. I mean, that's not a thing that existed then.
It's where it came from. You know, doing things normally was no longer in my genome. That's what I meant by permanently damaged. You were supposed to do things like that. But the primary motivation for starting Fenton Communications was not economic. I mean, I thought maybe it could be a business. I wasn't sure. And the early supporters of the company were mostly philanthropists, especially the Rockefeller family. Which supported a lot of our anti-nuclear weapons and social justice work. But, yeah, it was easy for me to think that way because look what I had come from. I mean, I remember when I left Ann Arbor, I left Detroit. As I said, I was very disillusioned. I was really depressed. I mean, look, I was a high school dropout. I had never been to college. I had never had anything that anyone could describe as a job. And I'm flinging myself on New York. I have no idea what I'm going to do. And so I take the train to New York from Detroit, which is, what, 14 hours or something ridiculous. And I struggle on this train to write a resume. How the hell am I going to package myself for employment? And I remembered, because by then I had already gotten my FBI files, that the FBI had said I was very good at public relations. So I did two versions of my resume. I figured they're going to be activists I'm going to interview with, and then there's going to be just plain old vanilla jobs. So I did two versions, and one version started with the FBI quote. It said, "Subject David Fenton demonstrated himself as an outstanding public relations man, FBI." That was my calling card. I mean, who could make this stuff up? It was just wild. Of course, the FBI was following me in New York when I was 16 and 17 years old taking photographs, you know, and there were debates in the FBI files, you know, was he advocating the violent overthrow of the government or not? At 17. Insane. It was just completely insane. I got my Michigan State Police files, too. They were watching everything. I really think a very important historic question is what was the counterintelligence, the police provocateur and infiltration work that was done here. You can be sure there was a lot of it, and we've never unearthed it. So there's a project for a PhD candidate.
Yeah. I wanted to ask you about the Occupy Wall Street movement. Are you working with them, and are you optimistic about where it's going?
I am very optimistic, and I think what's been accomplished is breathtaking. In 45 days, the notion of the importance of income inequality in this country has become a dominant theme. That's breathtaking. You know, you go out on the street, and I don't mean in Ann Arbor. You can go to, you know, Grand Rapids and say, what does 91.9 versus 1 mean? And everybody can tell you. And in August, nobody could. Wow. And now, you know, the president's talking about income inequality, and the governor of New York just reversed himself and put forward a millionaire's tax. You know, Bill Gates was just at the G20 meeting insisting there be a financial transactions tax. So the whole context has changed, and I don't think it will ever go back. You know, probably the mayor of New York did those kids a favor clearing them out of the park, because the story was moving too much towards, you know, the sort of seedy characters and the sanitation. And so now they don't have that problem. And as is often the case in history, was certainly true in the 60s, the excesses of the police were probably the main catalyst that made it cross over. So I've done some volunteer work with some of them. I'm not deeply involved. My ex-wife is very involved. She's kind of their press secretary, den mother. And she was just beat up by the police and had a terrible concussion. 55-year-old petite blonde woman. But I've helped them, some of them, their designated spokespeople, with some message work and some language, and, you know, put them in front of a camera and rehearse them some. And it would, you know, a lot of it's very familiar to me because, first of all, they have these crazy anarchists in their group, and eventually they're going to have to break with them. I suggested to some of them, I said, well, why don't you negotiate with the mayor for a permanent encampment? Because they're not going to let you stay in this park. It's too noisy and there's no facilities. And they said, well, you know, we're not going to negotiate with the mayor. I said, why not? They said, well, we don't recognize the legitimacy of his authority. So I understood exactly.
You've been through that before.
Right. And I said, well, you know, maybe, that's a little abstract, and more important is you've captured the imagination of the country. You should sort of keep this thing going. And then I would write things for them, and of course they'd have to take it back to the General Assembly and get consensus on every word, and then come back. And actually, it worked. We kept the message stuff very strong. And a lot of times, when you go through committees, you know, it just gets turned into mush. So yeah, it's been interesting. I'm sure it will have a lasting impact. I'm certain of it, because America's not supposed to be about 1% owning 40% of the wealth and getting one out of every $4 in the economy. I mean, that's just not America.
To learn more about David Fenton, visit freeingjohnsinclair.org.
AADL Talks to David Fenton has been a production of the Ann Arbor District Library.